mass of color is more beneficial to the members of that mass than would be a single individual, however brightly and warningly colored. So if arthropod predation is less important than vertebrate predation, and a big bunch of color is better than a little bunch of color, then the advantage to herbivores in joining such an association, even with predators, that advantage would be greater than the disadvantage of the occasional predation upon those herbivores by those predators. Now, another possible explanation, which is not in conflict with, but in fact would accompany that, the group warning explanation, is the fact of biochemical constraints. First of all, the basic ground color of insects, of course, is brown, light to dark brown to almost black. And this is achieved or accomplished. It's a measure of the consequence of the degree of oxidation of tyrosine in the cuticle, and to some extent the degree of tanning, but primarily the oxidation of tyrosine, which is a very simple, it's what you see when you expose, you cut open an apple or a potato and it turns brown. It's a very simple, it's what happens when you get, when you are out in the sun, the skin you get dark because the skin is saying, you're really stupid to be out in the sun where the ultraviolet can damage you, so skin is smarter than you are and is going to turn brown and protect you from the ultraviolet. It's just, it's a very simple reaction. But if brown is the basic, and it is, since brown is the basic ground color of insects, and if there is some evolutionary constraint, I have to be teleological because it's so much easier, if there's some evolutionary adaptive advantage to being in contrast with brown, the best colors to do that are white, yellow, orange, and red. If you're blue or green or what, these are not good contrast with brown. Well, of these colors, at least the last three, yellow, orange, red, are biochemically similar. They are steps along a fairly simple biochemical pathway. Therefore, the same, I think, is true if the ground color overall is to change from some form of brown to something else, something aposematic, something, well, not like those, but something bright. It's more likely to turn to white, yellow, orange, or red. Those are the easiest, in teleological terms, those are the easiest colors to which brown can, into which brown can change. These are the easiest, they're the least energetic. They require the less energy to become. If this is so, then it's not difficult, evolutionarily speaking, for aposematic insects to arise, and if they're conspecific herbivores, to aggregate on the same food plant and start forming and form a mass. Other like-colored species may then also arise, either convergently or as mimics, Batesian or Mullerian mimics. If mimics, it is clearly adaptively good for the mimics to be part of the aggregation of which the models are another part. If the similar color or similar pattern arises by convergence, it would still be biologically useful to be part of the aggregation, or at least to be part of an association of the few. As soon as I wrote that phrase, I began to think of our president in there, but never mind. But how these would find one another, I don't know. I haven't speculated that far. So if this is so, and if the type of aposematic coloring is constrained biochemically to yellow, orange, red, it seems reasonable that one should expect that similar colors and patterns would arise convergently in quite different parts of the world. Here is a pericorid from Bolivia and a regivid from Africa. Now, no one could ever suggest that one arose because it was going to sneak up from, say, move from Tanganyika and slip over and bring the death-dealing stab to the Dysdurcus on the left. On here, here's a pericard from Africa and a regevead from Florida. And to this group, you might also, in your mind, add the large milkweed bug, Oncopeltis sassiatus, especially the red-orange form. Not so much the pale orange, but the red-orange one. Looks very much like this. So maybe it's not good to be green. So then. How much do I have time for another disquisition?
4 minutes.
4 minutes, okay. I don't really have any summary for this except to go to repeat what I said in 4 minutes, which I do not intend to try. But I did then start asking myself, why are so many of the associations, and there are lots of other associations that I would have shown you except the specimens were so dusty, even Jane and her interesting vocabulary would be unable to have made worth photographing. But the question then occurred to me, why are so many of these associations, these color similarities, these color pairs, whatever one calls them, why are so many of them a pericard regevead association? And the short answer to that question is, I don't know. But the more speculative one is, perhaps I just noticed pericards more because I studied them somewhat, and I've got more of them in my collection. And maybe I know regeveds more because I've got a fair number of them identified from South India, identified by Dunstan Ambrose. So maybe I'm just more aware of them, I don't know. But then I suspect that a larger percent of pericard species, even excluding Dysdyrchus, that a larger percent of pericard species are aposematic than of other pentatomomorphin groups. Maybe. It seems to me that's the way. Then, having thought of that, which is may or not be, that may or may not be true, but at this point I don't care because it leads on to another thought, which also may or may not be true. And maybe each family group, and I'll give some examples, maybe each family group has a kind of basic defense method. Method, by the way, you notice is a useful word because it can suggest either behavior or some structural modification. So here's some things that occur to me. Pericardy, bad taste and aposematicism, and to some extent, and some mimicry. There are certainly mimics in pericardy, especially in some of the Asian ones. And it could be, and the interesting thing about Dysdyrchus is that it's warningly colored underneath, more so than it is from above. But nevertheless, it's warningly colored. So pericardy, their basic defense method is tasting bad, probably, and being aposematic. The tribe, then the other family in the pericardy is the Largidae. If we look at the subfamily Largini, we have the tribe Largini. That's mostly Largus in the New World. In fact, the entire subfamily Largini is New World. Some of these are contrastingly colored, but for the most part, I don't know if they have any basic. My God. Okay. Let me summarize the next 75 pages. The defense mechanisms are things like ant mimicry, which occur, and these things occur at least in the pentatomomorpha. These things occur not individual, not scattered throughout a family group. But they are characteristic of family groups, either of immature halogynes or of adult and immature colobathristids or of microlaprionolitids and so on. Small insects, small bugs, certainly the group that I'm interested in, tend to have spines on them, on the thorax and on the scutellum. Some of these things, there's a tribe of Physopeltine pericards that is huge, this long, and vividly red. So I think, there may be something to the notion that these groups have some kind of fundamental, basic, whatever you want to call it, family group trait, which they use for protection.
That's it. Questions?
I hope not.
Yeah, Toby.
Well, it seemed to me that if you contrasted Carver Corroy's, well, I can't tell why you can fire the courts apart from the you probably can't, that you would come to the conclusion that they both have the capability, both families have the capability to produce this red and black stuff.
Producing what? I'm sorry.
Both of them can produce red and black
Form.
So have you looked at the food plants? Scott might have some comments on that. But have you looked at the plants that are eating to see if they're picking up toxic compounds?
Dysdurchus and some of its relatives. Most of them to me, and to most people, they exist in museums as corpses on impaled on pins. But some Dysdurchus feed on the same sort of things that Leptochorus and Jadera do. No, they don't. They don't feed on the same thing. Right.
Are there any toxic compounds?
I don't know. I mean, this is the group to which cotton belongs. You know, these Dysdurchus are cotton stainers, as you know. So, what?
We eat cotton oil.
Yeah. So I don't know. I know. Well, let me put it more negatively. I have no evidence that any of these insects get noxious compounds from their food. That doesn't mean that they don't have them because they could manufacture them. But as you know, for the most part, that doesn't happen. But then the question is. I also don't think that these Regevias are so host-specific that they would only feed on prey that have these toxins in their own bodies. Because if the argument is that you only get toxins from the food that you eat, then clearly the Regevias would have to be getting it from their insect prey.
Are stored in a directory structure that simply reflects the taxonomic hierarchy, so I can find things again very quickly. So in this example, somewhere on the C drive, I got a folder for the United States National Museum of Natural History and Heptacelio and then Lugens, and then I'll have all the images, the montage images, the label images, and anything else that goes with that, just so I can find things quickly. These are holotypes. I'm not trying to illustrate characters of species. I'm not trying to illustrate what the species looks like. I'm trying to illustrate what this crummy specimen looks like, half embedded in glue, covered with dirt. I don't try to clean them, except unless there's something really gross that can be removed quite quickly. The real thing that affects the rate at which we can take images, well, actually there are five things there. One is getting the specimen in the right position in the first place. That's the most important one. A little bit of cleaning, maybe. Fussing around with the lights. As I said, the LED dome greatly reduces that time. Actual image capture, even if you're taking 25 images, 40 images, then making a montage with that computer, it's not really an issue. The fifth one, of course, is people talking to you. What are you doing? How are you doing that? How does that work? So I really can't give you numbers as for how fast we can take specimens. In 2 days, the USNM, we did all, I think it was 50 holotypes of the type species of genera with just me doing that. So we got it done. It would have taken us months to try to borrow all that material and take the pictures back home. This image, you see, I'm not sure how it shows up here, but you can see probably that it's got the classic auto-montage, funky, patchy background that none of us like, and a lot of us then have to go in either an auto-montage in Photoshop and edit that out so you get a nice-looking image. The bug itself is quite fine. I have no problems with the bug. But the background, I would like to clean up. We don't do any of that on the road. Figure, you know, I'm halfway across the world. I'm not going to spend my time fussing around this image. I need to get that next specimen in there and get the images. So I'll create the montage so that I know that there's not something horribly wrong, you know, like there was some vibration on the table that I didn't know about or something like that. Make the montage, make sure it's usable, and then just store the thing. In the when I originally started out, how many pictures do you take for a stack? I don't know. I didn't know. I ended up with taking a standard 25 images per picture, each of those 4 megabytes in size, so that plus the montage gives you a total of about 104 plus or minus megabytes per image. With the new system, and actually now with AutoMontage, we know what the depth of field is at each stop of magnification on the microscope. So we could just pop up a little calculator. We know the total depth of field of the image that we want to take. We know the depth of field at each stop, so just do that division and figure out how many pictures we need. And sometimes it surprisingly comes out to as few as 3 or 4 images is all we need to get a fully focused image. So that really not so much speeds up the time, but it reduces the amount of storage space that we have to use for the whole stacks. I'm a little bit paranoid, so we've got the stuff on the hard disk on the microcomputer, but I also copy this stuff over to an external hard disk so that we've got an extra copy of that. In the ideal world, I'd be able to upload that stuff over the internet, but of course, because of security reasons and just bandwidth reasons, you can't do that when you're visiting somebody else. We take pictures of the holotype labels. As I say, most of the types don't need globally unique IDs. The name and that this is a holotype suffices, but this is what the type labels for us would look like. And the setup is a simple Nikon Coolpix, I forget which number, macro camera on a $20 photo stand that I found on the internet, piece of gray card with a piece of glass taped to it, so we'll flip that glass up over to hold the labels down, shoot a picture, and put it in the same folder with all the other images eventually. Transport, if I'm driving, I just pop it in the trunk. If I'm flying, it's too big to take for carry-on, obviously. You could take it as accompanied checked baggage. I've never done that. The original system slightly exceeds the limits, and of course, with the 20 kilogram limit within Europe, it's much too heavy. I've shipped it via DHL. And basically, the cost to ship it by DHL is comparable to excess baggage costs. But the real killer is the insurance, which is usually 5% of the cost of the equipment. So that gets to be very expensive, but I felt compelled to do that. Getting into the countries is the real tribulation. Canada's straightforward. As long as I'm bringing it back out, they don't care. If you're going to pay customs duties, even though it'll be refundable because it's a temporary import, that's 20% of the value of a piece of equipment paid up front. I'm told that if you take it as accompanied baggage, you could describe it as photographic equipment. That's something that customs officials are familiar with and willing to and capable of dealing with. The other option is basically to get a passport for the system, a carnet. Don't laugh, I did this.